Way, Jefferson listened. I concur with entire satisfaction in your amendment of my resolution. Despite the founders' initial instincts, there would be no tests of political faith at Jefferson's university. There remained, however, an unresolved tension between Jefferson's vision of the University of Virginia as America's premier national institution for higher education and the increasingly sectional character of his own thinking. What began as a suitable American alternative to Oxford or Cambridge, where America's natural aristocracy could be trained for the responsibilities of national leadership, became more provincial as Jefferson's obsession with a northern conspiracy of consolidationists grew more severe. As the buildings in Charlottesville were going up, his own optimistic version of a national university was going down, replaced by a more narrow and defensive sense of his school as a southern fortress, where Virginia's young men could seek refuge from the poisonous environment of Harvard or Yale, which now specialized in producing fanatics and Tories. Here was yet another manifestation of his Virginia writ large version of patriotism toward the end. Two truly distinctive features of the university were very much a projection of Jefferson's personality. First, most of the traditional rules and curricular requirements that govern the operation of all other American colleges were completely abandoned. There were no distinctions among freshmen, sophomores, or upperclassmen. Jefferson also wanted to leave everyone free to attend whatever branches of instruction he wants, and to decline what he does not want. No specific courses or programs of study were required. It was a wholly elective system, indeed the rejection of any prescribed system at all. Nor was there any separate administration. The school was to be run by the faculty, with the cooperation of the students, all overseen by the Board of Visitors. Jefferson was insistent that his university be devoted to the principle of self-government, which meant that proctors, provosts, and even a president were superfluous. When the opportunity arose to attract William Wirt, the renowned biographer of Patrick Henry, as the first professor of law, Jefferson was enthusiastic, that is, until he learned that Wirt's acceptance was conditional upon his being named president. He blocked the appointment on the ground that his university did not require an executive presence. In keeping with his wishes, the University of Virginia did not have a president until 1904. In sum, the internal architecture of Jefferson's academical village was just as original as its physical exterior, and the guiding principle was not classical or Palladian, but rather the removal of all forms of external authority. There was no need for flying buttresses to order or stabilize the interior structure of his university. All meaningful discipline was internalized and invisible. It was the epitome of the Jeffersonian ideal, a society without government. The second distinctively personal feature of his plan for the university used architecture to institutionalize an educational version of domestic intimacy and harmony. At one level, the campus plan was designed to replicate the idyllic New England village with its separate but proximate dwellings arranged around a common or green. This scheme maximized both independence and daily face-to-face encounters among neighbors. It almost certainly grew out of the thinking he had been doing about wards as the primal political and educational units in Virginia, where town meetings and schools were infused with those essential energies available only when participants knew one another in multiple contexts, and civic trust, like a natural force, was simply taken for granted. The chief flaw in his ward scheme for education, apart from the legislature's rejection of the plan as wildly expensive, was that Virginia was demographically different from New England. The population was spread out rather than clustered in towns. Nevertheless, the intimacy and authenticity of social interactions in the village environment appealed to Jefferson enormously, as the seminal source of what he was now willing to call the democratic spirit, or the civilized version of political purity present in the tribal culture of Indians. Whatever the demographic problems might be in Virginia, his academical village would create its own demography. Unlike Oxford or Cambridge, which replicated the Gothic world of castles and drawbridges, or the preferred American collegiate scheme of a single large building, which suggested a fortress or prison, the Jeffersonian school would recreate the autonomous intimacies of the New England village. At yet another level, the professors and students were clustered in conjugal units, with each professorial house flanked by student dorm rooms along a colonnade. The intent was to create the semblance of a family environment, with professors as quasi-parents or guardians. If the village was the idyllic essence of the harmonious society, the family was the essential component of the village, the place or space where mutual affection and familiarity came together and one learned, in all the invisible ways, to internalize discipline. The very design of the three-sided colonnade captured Jefferson's youthful ideal, which he cherished in his memories of William Small and George Wythe at William and Mary, of the teacher as mentor, friend, personal guardian. It aimed to close the distance both physically and psychologically between faculty and students, and thereby make learning benefit from the interpersonal dynamics one normally associated with family life in its most affectionate and attractive forms. Though illustrative of Jefferson's deepest and fondest convictions, this was all pure theory. The more mundane and palpable reality struck with a vengeance in September 1825, when a group of 14 drunken students rioted, broke windows up and down the colonnade, and threatened two faculty members with physical injury. In an inverted version of the honor code, none of the students proved willing to confess his own guilt or testify against his peers. The incident required the calling of a special meeting of the Board of Visitors in October, with the 82-year-old Jefferson in the chair. It was quite a scene. The aging patriarch was flanked by Madison and Monroe, the flower of the Virginia dynasty and all former presidents, at a large table in the rotunda, only recently completed. One of the students, Henry Tutwiler, described what happened. Jefferson rose to address the students. He began by declaring that it was one of the most painful events of his life. But he had not gone far before his feelings overcame him, and he sat down, saying that he would leave to abler hands the task of saying what he wished to say. His own world was falling apart just as he was about to leave it. Even the ideal world of perfect freedom, pure democracy, and human affection he thought he had created in Charlottesville refused to cooperate with his expectations. He seemed destined by fate to end up a disappointed idealist. Tragedy. The last few months were uniformly sad and grim, punctuated by one final effort to rescue at least a portion of his burdened estate for his heirs, and one last and truly defiant display of the inimitable Jeffersonian style. The depth of his indebtedness now defied even his awesome powers of denial, and the looming character of his own death quashed the long-standing illusion that something would turn up before he headed for the hereafter. To keep a Virginia estate together requires in the owner both skill and attention, he confided to Monroe, whose own financial prospects were also bleak, but skill I never had, and attention I could not have, and really when I reflect on all the circumstances, my wonder is that I should have been so long as 60 years in reaching the result to which I am now reduced. He was about $100,000 in debt. In modern equivalents, several million dollars. His one hope was a public lottery, which was officially against the law and therefore required a waiver from the Virginia legislature. If he could get the waiver, however, and if the lottery proved successful, he had some chance of selling off a portion of his estate and retaining Monticello, along with enough land to support his heirs and some fraction of his slave population. In February 1826, he drafted a lengthy petition to the legislature in which he reviewed the earlier history of lotteries in Virginia and, this must have been excruciatingly painful, provided an account of his lengthy public service on behalf of the state and the nation. For a man with Jefferson's sense of pride and personal honor, it was a truly desperate act justified only by his desperate circumstances. Then the legislature, in a fit of inexplicable ingratitude that also enhanced his embarrassment, denied his petition. "It is part of my mortification," he confessed to his equally bankrupt son-in-law, "to perceive that I had so far overvalued myself as to have counted on it, the lottery, with too much confidence. I see, in the failure of this hope, a deadly blast of all my peace of mind during my remaining days. You kindly encourage me to keep up my spirits, but oppressed with disease, debility, age, and embarrassed affairs, this is difficult. For myself, I should not regard a prostration of fortune, but I am overwhelmed at the prospect of the situation in which I may leave my family." A few weeks later, however, Jefferson's many friends and admirers successfully lobbied the legislature to reverse its decision. The approval of the lottery injected a last ray of hope into his final months of life. This hope, too, proved illusory, but Jefferson was not around to face the facts. He prepared his will in March with the expectation that Monticello would be salvaged from his creditors and some of his land would pass to his heirs. Knowing that the auctioneers would claim many, if not most, of his slaves, he chose to free 5 members of the Hemings family: Burwell, his personal servant, immediately upon his death, John Hemings and Joe Fawcett 1 year later, Madison and Eston Hemings, sons of Sally, who would be apprenticed to John Hemings until they were 21, then freed. Sally herself was not freed or mentioned in the will. Perhaps buoyed by the false hope that the lottery would rescue him from total ruin, he managed one last burst of bravado in late June, just before his final illness confined him to bed. Officials planning the Independence Day celebrations in Washington invited him to attend the ceremonies honoring the 15th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence on July 4th. Jefferson was in no condition to leave his mountaintop, but he agreed to send a written statement. He sensed that this would be the last public utterance, so he mustered up one final surge of energy, correcting and revising his statement with the same attention to detail that he had brought to the original draft of the Declaration and to his first inaugural. After gracefully regretting his inability to rejoin in Washington, the small band, the remnant of that host of worthies who joined with on that day in the bold and doubtful election between submission and the sword. He then offered his distilled final rendering of just what the band of worthies had done. "May it be to the world what I believe it will be, to some parts sooner, to others later, but finally to all, the signal of arousing men to burst the chains under which monkish ignorance and superstition had persuaded them to bind themselves, and to assume the blessings and security of self-government. All eyes are opened or opening to the rights of men. The general spread of the light of science has already laid open to every view the palpable truth that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few, booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God. These are grounds of hope for others, for ourselves. Let the annual return of this day forever refresh our recollections of these rites and an undiminished devotion to them." It was vintage Jefferson, the uplifting vision of the American Revolution as the opening chapter in the global struggle against the entrenched prejudices of the past, the lyrical language pitched at a height that caused one to look up and feel the inspiration as the head lifted to catch the verbal airbursts. As with his draft of the Declaration, the core idea was not original and never intended to be. Jefferson had been insisting on seeing the Revolution as a liberation movement, a breaking away, for half a century. Again, like the Declaration, the felicity of the style was also second-hand, borrowed from a famous speech delivered by Colonel Richard Rumbold on the gallows in 1685, before he was hanged for treason. Rumbold, a crusty Puritan soldier, had coined the phrases about saddles on their backs and a favored few booted and spurred ready to ride them, just before he went to his maker. Jefferson owned copies of several English histories that reprinted the Rumbold speech. Perhaps certain phrases had lodged themselves in his memory, then inadvertently leaped into his mind as he wrote. Or perhaps the borrowing was done consciously, justified on the ground that, like Rumbold, he was a dying man who should be permitted the leeway to claim a favorite piece of eloquence as his own. Whatever the truth, and no matter how personally despondent he was about the prospective fate of his family and his beloved Monticello, Jefferson sounded a triumphant final note that correctly captured his optimistic message to posterity. About the core meaning and the abiding significance of the American Revolution, he had no doubts. Jefferson was also unable to attend another ceremony 6 months later on January 15, 1827, when the estate and slaves of Monticello were put up for auction. Although his fear of living too long proved justified, his presidential demise on July 4, 1826, spared him the ultimate tragedy of watching all his worldly possessions, including 130 valuable Negroes, sold to the highest bidders. All America was still talking about the simultaneous death of Adams and Jefferson on the 15th anniversary to the day of their great collaboration of 1776, though in Virginia there were some expressions of resentment that Adams had edged his way into the dramatic departure scene with the great Virginian, even claims that reports of the date of Adams's death must be a damned Yankee trick. But it was true, and Adams's last words, "Thomas Jefferson survives," proved to be just as prophetically right in the long run as they were dead wrong at the time. Jefferson was fortunate in both senses, immortal for the ages but dead and gone on that cold January day when his surviving daughter and grandchildren saw Monticello dismembered and destroyed. His grandson, Jeffy, never forgot the sad scene, which he compared with a captured village in ancient times when all were sold as slaves. The auction lasted 5 days, and when it was over, the proceeds covered only a portion of Jefferson's monumental debt, which was passed on to his descendants, and the slaves he had vowed to protect as a benevolent father were sold to the highest bidder. His life had always been about promise, and his enduring legacy became the most resonant version of the American promise in the national mythology. But in his life, if not in his legacy, there were some promises he could not keep. Epilogue: The Future of an Illusion. The true Jefferson legacy is to be hostile to legacies. Joyce Appleby, 1993. Jefferson's ideas had also this felicity, and also perhaps a little too much of it. They come to birth a little too easily, and rest a little precariously on the aspirations and ideals of good men, and not sufficiently on the brute concrete facts of the world as it is. Carl Becker, 1944. What, then, is the historically correct Jeffersonian legacy? What, if any, are the values that the real person who was Thomas Jefferson embodied in his life that remain vital and viable over 2 centuries after he declared American independence? More than half a century after the historian Carl Becker posed the question in its most familiar form, it seems appropriate and even timely to ask ourselves again, what is still living in the political philosophy of Thomas Jefferson? The question, it must be noted, would strike Jefferson himself and the majority of professional historians as bizarre. Jefferson certainly wanted to be remembered, but he had little patience with historical heritage, which he tended to regard as burdens imposed on the present by the past. Joyce Appleby, one of Jefferson's most astute modern-day admirers, has put it nicely: the true Jeffersonian legacy is to be hostile to legacies. If he could make a miraculous appearance among us, it would be perfectly plausible for him to denounce the entire Jeffersonian enterprise as a massive waste of time. The present generations of Americans, he might well say, needs to liberate itself from the dead hand of ancestors and predecessors and seek its own fate and future. Indeed, only by doing so will we remain faithful to the core Jeffersonian convictions. Most historians would chime in with a different version of the same message. As they see it, the past is a foreign country with its own distinctive mores and language. All efforts to wrench Jefferson out of his own time and place, therefore, are futile and misguided ventures that invariably compromise the integrity of the historical context that made him what he was. Lifting Jefferson out of that context and bringing him into the present is like trying to plant cut flowers. Granted, this means protecting the purity of the past at the expense of abandoning its relevance to the present. But most historians would rather run the risk of antiquarianism than commit the sin of presentism. For better and for worse, however, Jefferson has long since broken through the barricades that historians set up between the present and the past. Different versions of him as both hero and villain are loose among us, and different claims on the Jeffersonian legacy have become a permanent feature of contemporary American culture. To be sure, Bill Clinton's calculated pilgrimage to Monticello and Ronald Reagan's uplifting recommendation that we pluck a flower from Thomas Jefferson's life and wear it on our soul forever represent the same transparent impulse to appropriate an icon for their own political purposes. Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, now icons themselves, perfected this technique long ago. In fact, a good case can be made that Roosevelt championed the construction of the Jefferson Memorial primarily to provide the Democratic Party with a symbolic counter to the Lincoln Memorial, which the Republican Party claimed as its own. Such political invocations and appropriations of the mythical Jefferson have only the faintest connection with the historical Jefferson, who is presumably resting comfortably in archival enclaves tended by vigilant but invisible scholars. While prominent figures quote from Jefferson without fear and without embarrassment at their ignorance, there is also an ongoing conversation of equivalent superficiality occurring at all hours of the day and night on the Internet. When John Adams spoke his last and most prophetic words, "Thomas Jefferson survives," he had no way of knowing about cyberspace. But there is now more talk about Jeffersonian topics, i.e. Tom and Sally, Jefferson and Newt Gingrich, Monticello recipes, Jefferson and God, on America Online, than any other historical figure. In February 1996, the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation injected at least a semblance of informed opinions into these otherwise gossipy exchanges. "Monticello is pleased to announce its presence on the World Wide Web," the foundation declared, offering access to "A Typical Day in Jefferson's Life in the Early 1800s," among other topics. In several senses, cyberspace is the perfect Jeffersonian environment, an ethereal place where shifting images and impressions float freely and without any pretense of coherence. Likewise, the personal computer is the perfect Jeffersonian instrument. It allows ordinary individuals to communicate from the privacy of their solitary studies with laptop machines that a reincarnated Jefferson would surely regard as the modern analog to his laptop desk. All this only reinforces the realization that maintaining scholarly control over Jefferson's memory and legacy is a long-lost cause. To revisit Carl Becker's old question, then, what is still living, is really to join an ongoing conversation that most scholars have simply chosen to avoid. Becker's formulation of the question also implicitly suggests that any answer with pretensions of historical accuracy must begin with the recognition that substantial portions of Jefferson's legacy are no longer alive. They have died a natural death somewhere between 1826 and now. Perhaps the best way to visualize that process is to imagine a series of sandcastles on a beach, located different distances from the shoreline, but all vulnerable to the tide of time. The first major wave to strike was the Civil War, which destroyed slavery, the political primacy of the South, and the doctrine that the states were sovereign agents in the federal compact. After 1865, Jefferson's Virginia writ large version of the United States was gone with the proverbial wind, and his convictions about the proper distribution of power between state and federal governments, if not completely washed away, were permanently put on the defensive. A second wave, really a series of waves, struck between 1890 and 1920. In 1890, the census of the United States revealed that the frontier phase of American history was over. Frederick Jackson Turner's influential essay, The Significance of the Frontier in American History, 3 years later, announced that the frontier is gone, and with its going has closed the first period of American history. Then the census of 1920 reported that for the first time, the majority of American citizens lived in urban as opposed to rural areas. And between these two dates, the United States accepted a huge influx of European and Asian immigrants that permanently altered the previously Anglo-Saxon character of the American population. Taken together, these demographic changes transformed Jefferson's agrarian vision into a nostalgic memory. His belief in the recessive powers of the West into a democratic myth, and his presumption of Anglo-Saxon hegemony into a racial relic. The third wave arrived in the 1930s with the New Deal. In hindsight, one could actually see it coming from the early years of the 20th century, when the effects of urbanization, industrialization, the increased density of the population, and the exponential growth of corporate power over the economy combined to generate a need for a more centralized government to regulate the inequities of the marketplace and discipline the boisterous energies of an industrial economy. Herbert Crawley's The Promise of American Life, 1909, had prophesied and championed these political changes, but it took Roosevelt's New Deal to implement and institutionalize them. Roosevelt's appropriation of Jefferson as a New Deal Democrat was one of the most inspired acts of political thievery in American history, since the growth of federal power during the New Deal represented the triumph, in Jeffersonian terms, of consolidation over diffusion. The New Deal was, in fact, the death knell for Jefferson's idea of a minimalist government. The fourth and final wave came crashing down between 1950 and 1965. The onset of the Cold War in the late 1940s employed an essentially Jeffersonian moralism to mobilize public opinion against the Soviet Union. But with National Security Memorandum 68 in 1950, the United States committed itself to a massive military establishment to fight the Cold War that embodied precisely the kind of standing army and navy and air force that Jefferson abhorred. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court decision in Brown v. Board of Education, then the civil rights legislation of the early 1960s, institutionalized the ideal of a biracial American society, making Jefferson's belief in the physical and legal separation of blacks and whites an anachronism. Lyndon Johnson's great society, with its entrenched military establishment, its dedication to the welfare state, its extension of full citizenship to blacks and women, represented the epitome of political corruption in the Jeffersonian scheme, as well as the repudiation of racial and gender differences that Jefferson regarded as rooted in fixed principles of nature. The mention of fixed principles of nature suggests an entirely different series of waves generated by the winds of change in the scientific as opposed to the political world. Chief among these are the discoveries associated with Charles Darwin, Sigmund Freud, and Albert Einstein, which, taken together, completely shattered Jefferson's pre-modern assumptions about the physical principles that govern the national world, as well as the relationship between what he called the heart and the head. The entire mental universe in which Jefferson did his thinking has changed so dramatically, modern science has so unmoored all the fixed principles that he took for granted, that any direct connection between then and now must be regarded as a highly questionable enterprise. It should now be abundantly clear that the ingrained reticence of historians to translate Jefferson across the ages is rooted in more than mere timidity. It is grounded in a fuller appreciation of the sea change that separates his world from our own. To extend the image of sandcastles on the beach, it is not just that successive waves of change have swamped Jefferson's core convictions. It is also that the shape of the entire shoreline has been completely reconfigured. The decisive demographic and attitudinal changes that made the United States post-Jeffersonian occurred between 1890 and 1920. Ironically, one of the most discernible strands of Jeffersonian thought that remains very much alive is the steadfast reluctance, in some instances downright refusal, to accept the political implications of these changes. The chief voice for this potent version of Jeffersonian nostalgia in the late 20th century is the conservative wing of the Republican Party. Starting with Barry Goldwater in the 1960s, then reaching a crescendo of national success with Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, and continuing with Newt Gingrich's contract with America in the 1990s, the conservative movement has campaigned against the encroaching character of the federal government, much as Jefferson campaigned against the consolidating tendencies of the English Parliament in the 1770s, the Hamiltonian financial program of the 1790s, and the federal efforts to block the expansion of slavery in the 1820s. It is not just that the Republican desire to shift power from the federal to the state governments echoes Jefferson's constitutional preference. More significantly, the deeper echo is his profound hostility to government power per se. Indeed, since the end of the Cold War in 1989, the American government has replaced the Soviet Union as our domestic version of the evil empire. This is pure Jefferson, both in its congenital aversion to centralized authority, located far from local communities, and in its tendency to overlook the legitimate reasons why these political institutions at the federal level came into existence in the first place. Like Jefferson upon his ascendancy to the presidency in 1800, modern conservatives conceive their task as a dismantling operation designed to remove the accumulated political debris that is built up since the Golden Age. For Jefferson, the clock needed to be turned back to 1776. For modern conservatives, the target date is more elusive: 1963, pre-Great Society, 1932, pre-New Deal, even 1890, pre-progressivism. The underlying logic of conservative thought clearly regards the entire federal edifice that has developed in post-Jeffersonian America, that is, over the past century, as both dangerous and dispensable. One could argue that this is primarily a rhetorical posture, that no one seriously contemplates the elimination of Social Security or the Federal Reserve Board, that in fact the quadrennial assaults on the powers of the federal government have had little, if any, impact on the growth of federal spending or the size of the Washington bureaucracy. Nevertheless, the rhetorical prowess of Jefferson's anti-government ethos should not be underestimated as an influence on the special character of political discourse. Unlike any other nation-state in the modern world, the very idea of government power is stigmatized in the United States, and it is the residual power of Jeffersonian rhetoric that keeps government on the defensive. This potent strand of Jeffersonian thought remains alive and well in the conservative wing of the Republican Party. The persistent and even reinvigorated vitality of the anti-government ethos cuts two ways, however, because its rhetorical relevance as a distinctly Jeffersonian way to frame questions about public policy means that on the most disturbing and controversial problems in contemporary American society, abortion, drugs, poverty, crime, the Jeffersonian legacy has little to say. The debate about such problems is a debate about government's proper role, and from a Jeffersonian perspective, government should have no role at all. As Carl Becker put it, Jefferson believed that the only thing to do with political power, since it is inherently dangerous, is to abate it. Within that anti-government context, Jefferson's most enduring legacy is the principle of religious freedom, defined as the complete separation of church and state, though he would be distressed to know that the chief defender of this negative principle in the last half of the 20th century has been the Supreme Court, the branch of government he hated most. Nevertheless, the principle that the government has no business interfering with a person's religious beliefs or practices is the one specific Jeffersonian idea that has negotiated the passage from the late 18th to the late 20th century without any significant change in character or coloration. His other enduring legacies are less specific and must be sought at more rarefied regions, where the thinner intellectual atmosphere makes it much easier to mistake platitudes for ideas. Two examples of the dangers entailed in working in such altitudes might serve as object lessons that improve our prospects of avoiding the same vacuous fate. First, a host of otherwise intelligent commentators followed the lead of Gunnar Myrdal in An American Dilemma, 1943, have claimed that the core ideas of what he called the American Creed, as first articulated by Jefferson in the Natural Rights section of the Declaration of Independence, constitute the intellectual common ground on which America's many different racial and ethnic groups can congregate. Jefferson's most eloquent words and the ideas of freedom and equality they proclaim thereby become the intellectual cement or glue holding multiracial America together. Not only is it rather preposterous to believe that an abstract idea can perform such a massive social function, but it also flies in the face of all that we know about the historical Jefferson to make him an advocate of racial equality or the modern-day multiracial ideal. He was a staunch believer in white Anglo-Saxon supremacy, as were several other leading figures in the revolutionary generation. Moreover, he went out of his way to identify the differences between the races as products of nature rather than nurture. Martin Luther King Jr. was right to deliver his I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, for it was Lincoln's expansive revision of the original Jeffersonian version of the natural rights philosophy that broadened the message to include blacks. While it is plausible to cite Jefferson as an enemy of slavery, though even here the evidence of his life contradicts the logical imperatives of his thought, it is a wholesale distortion of both his life and his thought to describe him as a friend to racial integration. Second, Jefferson has become the preeminent historical source for presidents and public officials eager to sound an optimistic note about the superiority of American political institutions and ideas and the foreordained character of their eventual triumph. A host of Jeffersonian quotations can in fact be gathered to support this most optimistic form of patriotism. The Cold War, for example, was waged within the intensely moralistic and dualistic Jeffersonian categories of thought, and it is neither implausible nor ahistorical to imagine Jefferson describing the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989 as the culmination of the global struggle launched with the American and French revolutions. The long-term war of ideas fated to replace despotic regimes dependent upon coercion with representative governments and market economies based on popular consent and personal voluntarism. On the other hand, it is misleading, and in the end, dead wrong, to equate Jefferson's optimism about the outcome of the international struggle, often depicted in cosmic terms with providential guarantees, and his more specific vision of the United States as the eternal city on the hill. Jefferson did not believe, as Ronald Reagan put it, that it is always morning in America. Toward the end of his life especially, he was extremely pessimistic about the long-term viability of the American nation he had helped create. Although it is true that he was distinctive within the revolutionary generation for his way of describing America's limitless horizons, even Jefferson shared with his fellow founders the realistic realization that all nations, including the United States, had limited lifespans. Madison, writing in 1829, predicted that the American Republic would last for another 100 years, a prediction that must have looked eerily prescient at the start of the Great Depression. Adams oscillated between apocalyptic warnings that the end was close and more sanguine projections ranging up to another century and a half. Even though one of the most seductive features of Jeffersonian thought was its capacity to levitate out of its specific historical context, Jefferson shared with other members of the revolutionary generation the belief that all rising nations must eventually fall, that America's political success depended on a favorable set of social, economic, and demographic conditions, chiefly the existence of vast tracts of Western land that would eventually run out. As Drew McCoy has so succinctly put it, Jefferson hoped to delay the inevitable ravages of time by extending the American experiment through space. John Kennedy's New Frontier represented the same Jeffersonian impulse projected into space itself. As we have seen, those favorable conditions disappeared between 1890 and 1920, so that the entire political landscape of 20th century America would have struck Jefferson as alien, indeed symptomatic of American degeneration along what he regarded as the corrupt path of the British Empire. If, in other words, we wished to conjure up Jefferson standing atop the Berlin Wall and leading the cheers for its demolition, we must also realize that the victorious version of democratic politics and capitalist economics triumphant at the end of the 20th century was not at all what he had in mind. Virtually all commentators who ascend into the rarefied regions in pursuit of Jefferson's enduring legacy eventually end up discovering its essence in the natural rights section of the Declaration of Independence and the ideal of individual freedom it so eloquently celebrates. At the beginning of the 20th century, Woodrow Wilson, questing after what he called the spirit of Jefferson, found in it the right of the individual to a free opportunity. At the end of the century, Joyce Appleby, engaging in the same quest, also concluded that Jefferson's most enduring legacy, entailed on us in the name of nature, has been a particular understanding of human freedom. In between these interpreters, countless orators, statesmen, and scholars have sounded a similar note, usually as part of a patriotic hymn in which Jefferson has proved a serviceable source for campaigns against foreign foes, such as Germany, Japan, and the Soviet Union, or in domestic battles against such contradictory targets as labor unions and corporate power, welfare legislation and entrenched poverty, the death penalty, and the right to die. Jeffersonian rhetoric lends itself naturally to this kind of benign dilution and functional promiscuity. Where the real Jeffersonian idea ends and the platitudinous cant begins has become an unanswerable question. Clearly, Jefferson's own conception of individual freedom was more restricted than modern-day notions. His vision was essentially negative, freedom from encroachments by either church or state. It was all a piece with his anti-government ethos and therefore incompatible with our contemporary conviction about personal entitlements, whether it be for a decent standard of living, a comfortable retirement, or adequate health care, all of which depend on precisely the kind of government sponsorship he would have found intrusive. His was the freedom to be left alone, which has more in common with 20th century claims to private rights than more aggressive claims to political or economic power. He really had little to say about the positive ways that Americans should use their individual freedom, though the 19th century scramble for wealth, then the 20th century pursuit of unprecedented levels of consumption, would surely have left him disappointed in his fellow man. For all those reasons, modern-day invocations of Jefferson as the apostle of freedom are invariably misleading and problematic. Nevertheless, even though the content of the idea has changed in several expensive ways since Jefferson's time, what has not changed, and what remains a truly powerful Jeffersonian legacy, is the format within which all considerations of personal freedom are framed. Alone among the influential political thinkers of the revolutionary generation, Jefferson began with the assumption of individual sovereignty, then attempted to develop prescriptions of government that at best protected individual rights and at worst minimized the impact of government or the powers of the state on individual lives. Both Adams and Madison, and to an even greater extent Hamilton, began with the assumption of society as a collective unit, which was embodied in the government, which itself should then be designed to maximize individual freedom within the larger context of public order. Jefferson did not worry about public order, believing as he did that individuals liberated from the last remnants of feudal oppression would interact freely to create a natural harmony of interests that was guided, like Adam Smith's marketplace, by invisible or veiled forms of discipline. This belief, as Adams tried to tell him in the correspondence of their twilight years, was always an illusion, but it was an extraordinarily attractive illusion that proved extremely efficacious during the rowdy takeoff years of the American economy in the 19th century, when geographic and economic growth generated its own topsy-turvy version of dynamic order. Not until the late 19th century, with the end of the frontier and the emergence of the massive economic inequalities of the Gilded Age, was it fully exposed as an illusion. But by then, the Jeffersonian formulation of individual freedom as the bedrock conviction and the privileged starting point in all political debates was firmly entrenched. Just as Jefferson himself was prepared to abandon the principle temporarily when great opportunities, i.e. the Louisiana Purchase, or great crises, the Embargo Act of 1807, required it, 20th century Americans have only been willing to adopt a more collectivistic mentality when threatened by the Great Depression or by foreign foes during World War II and then the Cold War. But individual sovereignty remains the seminal conviction and the ideological home base for all mainstream political thinking after the threats recede. It continues to frame political conversations in ways that pull all communal schemes and proposals for group rights, like affirmative action, on the defensive. At the end of his panoramic review of American democratic culture, Robert Weave has concluded that the Jeffersonian ideal of self-government, though a contradiction in terms, remains the abiding belief of most Americans. The substantial body of contemporary criticism that singles out individualism as the special curse of American democracy simply flies in the face of its history, telling Americans to improve democracy by sinking comfortably into community, by losing themselves in a collective life, is calling into the wind. There never has been an American democracy without its powerful strand of individualism, and nothing suggests there will ever be. For better and for worse, American political discourse is phrased in Jeffersonian terms as a conversation about sovereign individuals who only grudgingly and in special circumstances are prepared to compromise that sovereignty for larger social purposes. Finally, Jefferson created a particular style of leadership adapted to the special requirements of American political culture that remains relevant two centuries later. It is a style based on the capacity to rest comfortably with contradictions. If you begin with the conviction that government is at best a necessary evil, then effective political leadership must be indirect and unthreatening. It must cloak the exercise of power from public view, appear to be a tamer and more innocuous activity than it really is. If there is also an inherent disjunction between the ideals on which the nation is founded, i.e. individual freedom, equality of opportunity, and popular sovereignty, and the imperatives of effective government, imperatives which require the capacity to coerce and discipline the undecided and faint of heart, then effective leadership, especially at the executive level, must be capable of benign deception. And if the political culture claims to derive its authority from popular opinion, which is by definition divided over the contested questions of the day, then leadership must at least appear to be followship, and the knack of political survival requires the skill to use language in ways that permit different constituencies to hear what they are listening for. Within the corporate world and the military profession, late 20th century America does permit more direct, more conspicuous, less elusive styles of leadership. But in the political realm, authority remains severely circumscribed and must achieve its ends more covertly. Television has only intensified the manipulative milieu. Instant, more accurate polling techniques have only amplified the influence of popular opinion. The exponential growth in the size of government over the course of the century, at the same time as the Jeffersonian hostility to government flourishes in the deepest corners of the culture, places an even greater premium on paradox by enhancing the attractiveness of political candidates who, like Jefferson in 1800, claim to despise the federal government they are campaigning to head. Jefferson did not come to this style self-consciously, did not hone his personality to fit the requirements of popular leadership in a political culture inherently suspicious of government. The style came to him naturally. His protestations about public life were completely sincere. If he were reincarnated and invited to run for political office in our time, he would almost certainly decline in favor of the tranquility of Monticello. But by temperament and disposition, he possessed the internal agility to generate multiple versions of the truth, the rhetorical skills to propose policies that different audiences could hear favorably, the deep deviousness only possible in a dedicated idealist, the honest aversion to the very power he pursued so effectively. These remain invaluable political talents, and the bedrock moralistic simplicity of the Jeffersonian vision has only increased its political potency as the size of the American electorate has grown larger and more unwieldy. If we could ever persuade him to run, he would remain a formidable candidate for national office. Appendix. A note on the Sally Hemings scandal. Modern-day journalists and social commentators have frequently claimed that candidates for national office during the last third of the 20th century have been exposed to unprecedented scrutiny into their personal, especially their sexual, lives. While the proliferation of talk shows and tabloids has certainly intensified the appetite for scandal by making such stories readily available to a mass market, the primal urge to know about the sexual secrets of the rich or famous is apparently as timeless as the primal urge itself. Long before we learned about the sexual escapades of Presidents Kennedy or Clinton, or before them, Harding or Franklin Roosevelt, there was the story of Jefferson and Sally. Indeed, the alleged liaison between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings may be described as the longest-running miniseries in American history. The history of the story itself falls naturally, if not neatly, into three discernible phases. The first was the early 19th century, when James Callender published the initial accusations and the Federalist Press spread them across the country. Callender's motives, all historians agree, were scurrilous and vengeful. He probably heard the rumors about miscegenation at Monticello while imprisoned in Richmond. It was a story that had been making the rounds in Virginia for several years, and felt no compunction about reporting the gossip as fact. His charges, while obviously motivated by the basest personal and political motives, derived a measure of credibility from three different factors. First, Callender had accurately reported on the adulterous affair between Alexander Hamilton and Maria Reynolds in 1797. While wildly irresponsible and blatantly smut-seeking, he tended to exaggerate rather than tell outright lies. Second, Sally Hemings did have several children who were obviously fathered by a white man, and some of whom had features that resembled those of Jefferson. Third, Callender had correctly accused Jefferson of making unsolicited advances toward Elizabeth Walker, a married woman, when he was a young bachelor in 1768. Jefferson acknowledged the truth of this youthful indiscretion in 1805, made a public apology to her husband, John Walker, but claimed it was the only charge founded on truth among all their allegations against me. Nevertheless, the accuracy of the Walker accusation lent a measure of credibility to the Sally story. The next chapter in the story, which occurred in the middle decades of the 19th century, produced two new pieces of evidence, each important in its own right, but together contradicting each other. In 1873, Madison Hemings, Sally's next-to-last child, born in 1805, gave an interview to the Pike County, Ohio, Republican, claiming that his mother had identified Thomas Jefferson as his father and, in fact, the father of all her five children. The claim was verified by Israel Jefferson, another ex-slave from Monticello, also living in Ohio at the time, and a longtime friend of Madison Hemings. The following year, in 1874, James Parton published his Life of Thomas Jefferson and reported another story that had been circulating within the Jefferson and Randolph families for many years, to wit, that Jefferson's nephew Peter Carr had been the father of all or most of Sally's children, and that he had admitted as much to Martha Jefferson when she had confronted him with the charge. Sally's children looked like Jefferson then because they were related, but through Carr rather than Jefferson himself. This version of miscegenation on the mountaintop received partial corroboration from Edmund Bacon, the former manager of Monticello, who claimed in his interview of 1862 that he had seen another man leaving Sally's quarters many a morning. There were now two different versions of the Sally story placed before the public, one rooted in the oral tradition of the Hemings family, and the other in the oral tradition of the white descendants of the Jefferson Randolph family. The third chapter of the story dates from the 1950s, when the scholarship on Jefferson, especially the massive publication project led by Julian Boyd and the authoritative six-volume biography by Dumas Malone, generated fresh evidence and a new and spirited debate about its meaning. Although the most dramatic episode occurred in 1974 with the publication of Fawn Brodie's Thomas Jefferson, An Intimate History, a national bestseller that argued in favor of the liaison and even claimed that Jefferson and Sally Hemings loved each other, the new evidence, in fact, came from Malone. Despite his own forcefully argued conclusion that the Sally story was a fictional creation of Callender and nothing more, Malone's research revealed that Jefferson was present at Monticello 9 months prior to the birth of each of Sally's children. Since he was often away at Philadelphia or Washington, and since Sally never conceived in his absence, the timing of her pregnancies was compatible with his paternity. In 1993, the researchers at the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation discovered a missing daughter, born in 1799, who had died soon thereafter. That birth was also compatible with Jefferson's residence at Monticello. Although Brodie's book ignited a raging debate within the scholarly world, and then a proliferation of biographies, novels, films, and popular magazine stories, it was, in truth, Malone's findings about the chronology of Sally's pregnancies that constituted the most tangible piece of new evidence to support the charge of a sexual liaison. Where does that leave the matter? Well, unless the trustees of the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation decide to exhume the remains and do DNA testing on Jefferson, as well as some of his alleged progeny, it leaves the matter in a mystery about which advocates on either side can freely speculate, and surely will. Within the scholarly world, especially within the community of Jefferson specialists, there seems to be a clear consensus that the story is almost certainly not true. Within the much murkier world of popular opinion, especially within the black community, the story appears to have achieved the status of a self-evident truth. If either side of this debate were to file for damages in a civil suit requiring a preponderance of evidence as the standard, it is difficult to imagine an impartial jury finding for either plaintiff. Jefferson's most ardent defenders still live under the influence of what might be called the Virginia gentleman ethos, i.e., this is not something that a Virginia gentleman would do, which increasingly has the quaint and charmingly naive sound of an honorable anachronism. Meanwhile, those who wholeheartedly endorse the truth of the story, either in Callender's original version as a tale of lust and rape, or in Brodie's later rendering as a tragic romance between America's premier biracial couple, have also allowed their own racial, political, or sexual agenda to take precedence over the evidence. On the basis of what we know now, we can never know. This means that for those who demand an answer, the only recourse is plausible conjecture, prefaced as it must be with profuse statements about the flimsy and wholly circumstantial character of the evidence. In that spirit, which we might call the spirit of responsible speculation, after 5 years mulling over the huge cache of evidence that does exist on the thought and character of the historical Jefferson, I have concluded that the likelihood of a liaison with Sally Hemings is remote. Two pieces of circumstantial evidence strike me as telling. First, Sally's last two children, Madison and Esten, were born after Callender's charges created the public scandal in 1802, and it is difficult to believe that Jefferson would have persisted in producing progeny with Sally once the secret had been exposed and the Federalist press also poised to report it. Second, among Jefferson's contemporaries, neither Alexander Hamilton nor John Adams, both of whom were political enemies who undoubtedly enjoyed the sight of their chief adversary being stigmatized by the kind of innuendo he had spread against them, found it possible to believe that Callender's accusations were true, nor, for that matter, did Henry Adams, whose critical appraisal of Jefferson's character established the scholarly standard for ironic dissection. What Hamilton and both Adamses understood about Jefferson, and what my own immersion in the historical evidence has caused me to conclude as well, is that for most of his adult life he lacked the capacity for the direct and physical expression of his sexual energies. Henry Adams put it most explicitly when he said that Jefferson's temperament was almost feminine. When scholarly defenders like Dumas Malone and Merrill Peterson claimed that Jefferson was not the kind of man to engage in illicit sex with an attractive mulatto slave, They were right for two reasons that went deeper than matters of male gallantry and aristocratic honor. Jefferson consummated his relations with women at a more rarefied level, where the palpable realities of physical intimacy were routinely sublimed to safer and more sentimental regions. He made a point of insulating himself from direct exposure to the unmitigated meaning of both sex and slavery, a lifelong tendency that an enduring liaison with Sally Hemings would have violated in ways he found intolerable. He obviously knew about the ongoing miscegenation at Monticello, but his powers of self-deception and denial protected him from facing these facts, and his urge to remain oblivious was considerably stronger than his sexual drive. He was, to be sure, capable of living with massive contradictions, but his psychological dexterity depended upon the manipulation of interior images and personae. He was not that adroit at the kind of overt deviousness required to sustain an allegedly 38-year affair in the very center of his domestic haven. One could plausibly argue that his famous fear of racial mixing gathered its intensity from his personal encounters with its sensual attractions. But nothing that we know about Jefferson supports the linkage between sex and sensuality. His most sensual statements were aimed at beautiful buildings rather than beautiful women. In sum, the alleged relationship with Sally Hemings, if it did exist, defied the dominant patterns of his personality. It certainly did not defy the dominant patterns of racial interaction at Monticello or the slave quarters of many plantations throughout the antebellum South. The fact that only a small fraction of the black population in contemporary America is of purely African extraction constitutes the most palpable evidence that sexual relations between blacks and whites have a long, if secret, history. At the purely metaphoric level, then, the story of an enduring sexual connection between Jefferson and Sally Hemings conveys an elemental truth about the hidden history of race relations in America. At the same illustrative level, the very possibility of such a liaison accurately captures the inherently promiscuous character of Jefferson's elusive personality, especially when it encountered unpalatable realities. But metaphoric or illustrative versions of the truth are not the same thing as historical truth per se. For those predisposed to disagree with my conjectures about the unlikelihood of the relationship, the most disquieting piece of evidence they will need to absorb also relates to timing. For if the story is true, Jefferson's withdrawal from a leadership position in the anti-slavery movement began at the same time that the affair with Sally Hemings allegedly started. For those who wish to explore the evidence pro and con, the best summary of the case against the alleged liaison is Virginia Dabney, The Jefferson Scandals, A Rebuttal, New York, 1981. The best synthesis of the other side is the book by Annette Gordon Reed entitled Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, Historians and the Enterprise of Defense, soon to be published by the University of Virginia Press, which represents an attempt to enhance the credibility of Fawn Brodie's interpretation in Intimate History without recourse to Brodie's psychiatric paraphernalia. It is worth noting that Gordon Reed, who graciously allowed me to read her manuscript in process, is herself an agnostic on the question. So is Lucia Stanton of the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation, who supervises the ongoing research into the Hemings descendants and probably knows more about the evidence than anyone else. This concludes the reading of American Sphinx by Joseph J. Ellis. Copyright 1996 by Joseph J. Ellis. This unabridged recording of the reading of American Sphinx was published by arrangement with Alfred A. Knopf Incorporated and was produced in 1998 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book was read by Susan O'Malley.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.